Jesus. And again, we'll go through that again, but you don't need to know specifically the pathway. I think it's the only pathway you don't need to know. There's also some things about glutathione on the board, and we'll stop and emphasize those when we get to glutathione, which is part of the pentose phosphate pathway story. So I'm going to put up this big picture, which you have in your notes somewhere, as again a nice overview of where we are. So we've talked about glycogen, glycogenesis, or glycogen synthase being the key enzyme there. When genesis is going on, insulin is the hormone that is around. Glycogenolysis, glycogen phosphorylase, is the key enzyme. Glucagon would be the hormone that would be around when we're undergoing glycogenolysis. We've talked about the glycolysis pathway, the PDH, which converts pyruvate to acetyl-CoA, and the citric acid cycle, and the carbon from there comes out of CO2, but more importantly, we make NADH, FADH2, and 1-GTP. And then when we come back after the holiday on Monday, we'll talk about the electron transport chain, how we get energy from NADH and FADH2. Remember, anaerobic metabolism, particularly red blood cells, use the LDH, lactate dehydrogenase enzyme, to produce lactate from pyruvate. And so today we're going to do the pentose phosphate pathway, which you see here on your big picture. And again, glucose-6-phosphate is a key intermediate, as we've been saying. Now remember, you don't need to know this pathway. That means the enzyme substrates product. But you do need to know that the pathway is a source of NADPH, so it produces NADPH, which is involved in a lot of different biochemical reactions, including the glutathione story, which we'll talk about. It produces pentoses and more specifically ribose-5-phosphate, which is important in nucleic acid synthesis. So ribonucleotides, which remember are the building blocks of DNA and RNA, and also involved in biochemical reactions. And it interconverts pentoses, hexoses, and trioses. So it can basically change the size of sugars. So it goes in a variety. And that's basically what most of the pathway does, particularly in the bottom half. The pathway itself is actually divided into two halves. One is called oxidative and one non-oxidative. And the top half, which stops at about ribose-5-phosphate, is the oxidative branch. And the bottom half is from there on down. And that's where most of the interconversion of the sugars goes on. That's the non-oxidative branch. You'll notice that it's in the top half of the oxidative branch that we get the NADPH produced. And then in the bottom half, actually from the top half and goes into the bottom half, is the ribose-5-phosphate, and some of it then goes into nucleic acid synthesis. And then the whole bottom part with all the different enzymes and arrows is where we're interconverting sugars. So we're just changing the sizes, going from 5 to 6 to 3 carbon sugars. And this pathway is really important for the body, and it has different ways of meeting cellular needs for these different things, for NADPH, ribose-5-phosphate, and the need to interconvert sugars. And it turns out that the first case, when we need more ribose-5-phosphate, so for instance, for some reason, ribonucleotide synthesis has increased, we need excess ribose-5-phosphate more than we need NADPH. At that point, the pathway can actually reverse the non-oxidative branch, the bottom half of the pathway. It reverses that and goes back up and produces more ribose-5-phosphate, and it actually shuts down the top half, the oxidative branch. So it stops making NADPH because it doesn't need it. So it can shut off the top half and reverse the bottom half of the pathway. When we need NADPH, and we'll see in the glutathione case why in certain cases we may need an excess of NADPH, we need more NADPH than ribose-5-phosphate, then the oxidative branch is active. That's the top half. That's, of course, the part where we produce the NADPH. And the bottom half, the non-oxidative branch, you'll notice can then divert all of the ribose-5-phosphate that's being produced into glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate and fructose-6-phosphate. So those basically go into the glycolytic pathway so that we don't get a buildup of ribose-5-phosphate. Because if we didn't divert those into other pathways, the ribose-5-phosphate concentrations will build up and feedback inhibit and slow down the oxidative branch, which we don't want, because remember, we need for some reason, and we'll see a couple of reasons, excess NADPH. And then generally when there's a balance requirement for both NADPH and ribose 5-phosphate, the oxidative branch is active and the non-oxidative branch tends not to be active unless there's some particular reason to interconvert sugars. But generally when there's a balance need, the top half's active, so we produce some NADPH and some ribose 5-phosphate, which then go off into their particular pathways. So the body can use this pathway in a variety of ways to meet its different cellular needs. That's a little bit different than we've seen in a lot of the other pathways, how it can manipulate this particular pathway. One of the reasons it may need excess NADPH is what I call the glutathione story. And you'll notice on the board is the structure of glutathione. It's a tripeptide, so a very, very tiny protein. Consists of glutamic acid, cysteine, and glycine, glucis-gly. And glutathione reduced, the cysteine has that free reactive sulfur group. And glutathione oxidized is basically two glutathione molecules with a disulfide bond. So remember this reactive sulfur we talked about when we talked about amino acids and protein structure. If it gets anywhere near another one, it tends to form a disulfide bond very easily. So that's glutathione oxidized. Now there's two particular reactions that are important in the process of glutathione. And we'll kind of look at the bottom one first, the second one first, and that's the glutathione reductase. You notice it reacts with H2O2, which is hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide. That's not a typical molecule we see in biochemistry, and it's not particularly good to have it around, particularly in the plasma, because it damages red blood cells, which ultimately, if you have enough of it around, can lead to anemia if you damage too many red blood cells. One of the products of taking antibiotics tends to be H2O2. So you can see that there would be a need for this pathway to get rid of H2O2, which you'll notice in the second reaction, glutathione reduced actually scavenges H2O2, and the enzyme there is glutathione peroxidase, and it converts it into water. And you notice anytime something's being reduced, something has to be oxidized. So glutathione reduced is going to glutathione oxidized. And the top reaction then is how we keep the glutathione oxidized in its reduced form. Because it's going to want to be oxidized. Remember those reactive sulfurs are going to want to form a disulfide bond. But in order to keep it in the reduced form so it can scavenge peroxides, we need NADPH. And the enzyme that actually reduces the glutathione oxidized is glutathione reductase. And the name makes sense. It's a reductase. And it basically reduces glutathione oxidized into glutathione reduced. And so NADPH is what is coming from the pentose phosphate pathway. So this is one reaction where we need NADPH. There are many biochemically. But this is a particularly important one. And again, the NADPH is used along with the enzyme glutathione reductase to break that disulfide bond and give us glutathione reduced. And a time when we might need extra NADPH, again, would be a time like if you're taking antibiotics that tend to produce, as they are metabolized, H2O2. And so the body then has to kind of pick up NADPH production to get rid of, in other words, basically, it changes the H2O2, the hydrogen peroxide, into water, which of course is harmless, and that's fine. So again, the two enzymes there are the reductase and the peroxidase, and that's one of the reactions biochemically where we need NADPH. So again, pentose phosphate pathway, don't need to know the pathway specifically. You need to understand the glutathione story and understand the purposes of the pathway, what the body uses it for, to produce NADPH, to produce ribose 5-phosphate, and to interconvert a variety of sugars. So that kind of, in brief, is the pentose phosphate pathway. Now, the gluconeogenic pathway. And we've already kind of hinted at the gluconeogenic pathway when we talked about the glycolytic pathway. As we said, it is not exactly a reverse of the pathway, but fairly close. And we did say, I indicated on the pathway where we would have different enzymes, different between glycolysis and gluconeogenesis. And there's also two new enzymes that we're introducing in this pathway, and that's pyruvate carboxylase, which you see on your picture, converts pyruvate into oxaloacetate, pyruvate carboxylase, converting pyruvate to oxaloacetate, and phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase, which we never want to write that out, is PEPCK. PEPCK, and you'll notice it converts oxaloacetate into phosphoenolpyruvate. Now the first thing about the gluconeogenic pathway that you might notice, or hopefully notice, is that we can actually begin with lactate, alanine, and pyruvate. So all of those things can go into this pathway, and as we go up the pathway, ultimately become glucose-6-phosphate, our key intermediate. So again, notice we can start with non-sugar precursors. We can start with alanine that we know is an amino acid, and we can start with lactic acid, much of which is produced by red blood cells, which, remember, take the pyruvate after glycolysis and convert it into lactate or lactic acid. So notice all three of those things go in to the gluconeogenic pathway. Now, unfortunately, the pathway is not an exact reversal. It's a little more complex because there's some shuttling between the cytosol and the mitochondria. So again, remembering where things are happening in the cell, glycolysis and most of gluconeogenesis are in the cytosol. But notice some of the gluconeogenic pathway is in the mitochondria. So again, you'll notice lactate and alanine both become pyruvate in the cytosol. And pyruvate then is able to cross through the membrane from the cytosol into the mitochondria, which it does. And it's there that the enzyme pyruvate carboxylase resides and converts the pyruvate into oxaloacetate, which is also an intermediate in the TCA cycle. You remember we saw oxaloacetate at the beginning of the cycle. It condenses with acetyl-CoA to give us citrate, oxaloacetate. Then it is converted to phosphoenolpyruvate or into malate, again another intermediate in the citric acid cycle. And notice it's the PEPCK that can convert it to PEP, phosphoenolpyruvate. Also notice that PEPCK is both in the mitochondria and the cytosol. So it is an enzyme that is in both tissue types. Well, the only two things that can come out of the mitochondria and back into the cytosol are PEP or malate. And both of them come across that membrane from the mitochondria into the cytosol, and all ultimately end up as PEP. So basically we're starting, if we're comparing glycolysis and gluconeogenesis, with phosphoenolpyruvate in the cytosol. And then we're going to kind of go back up the pathway. Pyruvate carboxylase, which again converts pyruvate to oxaloacetate, requires biotin. So biotin is a prosthetic group for the enzyme, and it basically carries the CO2 molecule that's needed. It also requires energy in the form of ATP. So when we initiate gluconeogenesis, it requires energy. The enzyme pyruvate carboxylase is actually activated by excess acetyl-CoA. So if concentrations of acetyl-CoA start building up, two things happen. It activates pyruvate carboxylase, and it also inhibits the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex. And we talked about that when we talked about the PDH. We said the PDH is feedback inhibited by its product, acetyl-CoA. So if we get too much acetyl-CoA, we slow down the PDH, and we can also speed up the pyruvate carboxylase. So in other words, speed up the conversion of pyruvate to oxaloacetate. And all of that, again, is part of the homeostasis that's going on between all of these pathways in the big picture and trying to keep everything at very specific concentrations. In terms of gluconeogenesis, the rate-limiting step is the PEPCK. The PEPCK. It requires a little bit of energy as well, but this time it's in the form of GTP rather than ATP. And this is an enzyme that's actually induced, so it comes from the genetic level, induction. Remember, induction repression, during starvation. So times when there's been long fast, long time. So we've used all our glycogen stores, glycogenolysis has occurred, we've used all that we have. We need to get heavily into gluconeogenesis, and this enzyme is induced, PEPCK. Now the whole rest of the pathway is basically the reverse of glycolysis with two exceptions. So everything is basically double arrowed as you work from PEP back up to glucose-6-phosphate. And one of the exceptions that we mentioned is where you see fructose-1,6-bisphosphate becoming fructose-6-phosphate. That's a new enzyme that's different than in glycolysis. You remember in glycolysis, the enzyme at that step is phosphofructokinase 1, PFK1. And so if we're going the other direction in glycolysis, clearly we're converting fructose-6-phosphate to fructose-1,6-bisphosphate, which in your notes and also in the glycolytic pathway, remember, requires an ATP. That's a substrate-level phosphorylation. PFK1 is a kinase, and we're substrate-level phosphorylating fructose-6-phosphate. And ATP is providing the phosphate and the energy to do that. That's in the glycolytic pathway. So when we turn this pathway around and reverse it, we have a new enzyme, a different enzyme that's a phosphatase, is the name of the enzyme, fructose-1,6-bisphosphatase. And the reason that we have two different enzymes, and those are irreversible steps, is that we have to really regulate these enzymes, and we regulate them reciprocally, which is basically a big word that means together, so they're regulated at the same time. And we do that because you notice we don't regenerate that ATP. We use it in glycolysis, but we don't get it back in gluconeogenesis. So if we didn't regulate these two things together, we could get in a cycle at that particular reaction where we would lose ATP without conservation of energy. And just like the laws of thermodynamics, the laws of conservation of energy apply to biochemistry as well, which means we always have conservation. So we can't use ATP in a pathway like this where it's not regenerated in the reverse pathway. So we have two different enzymes, two irreversible reactions that are reciprocally regulated. And the regulation, again, is pretty complex, and we'll talk about it next semester in the allosteric regulation, which ties in all the pathways and how they're regulated. The other step that's different from glycolysis to gluconeogenesis is the conversion of glucose-6-phosphate to glucose. And it's only important for liver and kidney. So all of the other tissue types use glucose-6-phosphate. So all of the other tissue types can take pyruvate, lactate, and alanine, turn it into glucose-6-phosphate, and be happy. Because remember, glucose-6-phosphate is a key intermediate, goes in all these different pathways. But in the liver and the kidney, they can actually take glucose-6-phosphate and make glucose. And the enzyme there is glucose-6-phosphatase. And once again, these are irreversible reactions because we could form another what's called futile cycle, a cycle where we're using ATP without regenerating, where we lose conservation of energy. If these were not irreversible, meaning two different enzymes and also reciprocally regulated. Because again, remember back to glycolysis, the very first step is the phosphorylation of glucose to glucose-6-phosphate. And there, the phosphate, again, is supplied by ATP along with the energy to do that substrate-level phosphorylation. So if we just got into a loop in that particular step, then we would be in trouble in terms of conservation of energy. And again, this is specific, though, to liver and kidney. So most tissues this won't apply to. Okay, so the glucose-6-phosphate that's produced by the pathway, by the gluconeogenic pathway, is basically then usually transported to the endoplasmic reticulum where it's dephosphorylated, and then the glucose and inorganic phosphate are returned to the cytosol. And of course at that point then the glucose is going out to the plasma, because remember the reason we're undergoing gluconeogenesis is because plasma glucose levels have dropped sufficiently that we need to get this pathway going. And again, most of us will never see this pathway happening. This is quite a while after leaving the fed state, been quite a long, long time in the fasted state. And generally, gluconeogenesis doesn't become fully active until glycogen stores have been used up. And so this is really very fasted, really we can call almost a starvation state, that we're going to have gluconeogenesis fully active. This is for normal people. So the other two things you see here are the Cori cycle, which you've probably heard of, and also something called the alanine cycle or the glucose-alanine cycle. You do not have to know these cycles for the exam either. OK? okay? So those of you who are keeping track of that, these cycles are not particularly important, though they are very important biochemically. And you can see that lactate is about a 40% contributor to gluconeogenesis. And again, it's primarily generated by red blood cells and sometimes from muscle during high-intensity exercise. So when you build lactic acid in your muscles, which we've all felt, it is then a precursor to the gluconeogenic pathway or to what's called the Cori cycle here. And the Cori cycle, the key to it is it's really an interrelationship of how the liver and the red blood cells interrelate together. And again, the red blood cell, very simple, takes glucose, goes through glycolysis, makes pyruvate, sends it into lactate dehydrogenase enzyme, makes lactate. So glucose goes in, lactate comes out. So basically, when lactate is produced, the body's got to do something with it so it doesn't just build up, and the liver can actually use it and turn it into glucose. So the liver picks it up, goes through gluconeogenesis, and produces glucose. And although as you look at the cycle, it is actually a means for localized ATP production, the consequences of gluconeogenesis are actually an overall net loss of energy. So there's a fair amount of energy or ATP that goes into gluconeogenesis. Now alanine, that's about a 25% contributor to gluconeogenesis. And again, we know it's an amino acid. And the first step is the alanine is converted to pyruvate. That's an aminotransferase enzyme that you don't need to worry about. And again, the alanine-glucose cycle, or the alanine cycle, is relating now the liver with the muscle. So this is the interrelationship of the liver and muscle. So you notice muscle undergoes glycolysis, we know that, makes pyruvate, and the muscle can actually then get into the protein metabolic pathways and turn pyruvate into alanine. And when it does that, it expels the alanine, and again, we have to do something with the alanine so it doesn't build up. The liver can use alanine, go into gluconeogenesis, and make glucose. So again, it's kind of interrelating, and again, nice pictures to go back to, which I emphasize again are not on the exam, but are those pictures where we had each particular type, each tissue type that showed all the different metabolic pathways. And we went from red blood cell being very simple with no mitochondria, all the way up to the most complex, which was our liver, and we kind of built the pathway. So if you look back at those, they're really good to see how things interrelate. Again, the liver being really the powerhouse that does almost everything. Every pathway is going on in there. And so the liver is really vital. And again, with this cycle, there's an actual net loss of ATP. It turns out that glycerol can also enter the gluconeogenic pathway. So we can take alanine, lactate, pyruvate, and glycerol. So we have non-carbohydrate precursors entering this pathway. And of course, glycerol, we talked about way in the beginning, when we talked about lipids, particularly introduced lipids or fatty acids. And you remember back fatty acids being highly amphiphilic compounds or things we eat that come from our diet, free fatty acids. And we store them for use as energy, for use in membranes, as triglycerides or triacylglycerols. And so you remember the backbone for a triglyceride is glycerol. And so there's a lot of glycerol around. So again, glycerol, if it gets too high, again, always thinking of homeostasis and concentrations, can actually enter the gluconeogenic pathway. And it is a particular pathway that's only in the cytosol. And again, you don't need to particularly worry about how glycerol becomes glucose 6-phosphate, unless you're particularly interested in that. We can talk about that. So that's pretty much glucose.